Frequently, monsters involve darkness. And not just the darkness where you bark your shins into furniture or step with your bare foot on a wood screw that's there for no reason. The darkness is really where we keep our very best terrors. Juan Mas, our next storyteller, will tell us all about darkness. Juan Mas.
I don't remember exactly when I became afraid of the dark, but I do know that I wasn't always afraid of it. I think it was sometime when I was about 6 years old. I'm not sure what caused it, and that's what frustrates me, because I have a really good memory for things like that. Things that are emotional moments that impact my life, they burn themselves into my mind like a little film, which is probably perfect because I make my living as a filmmaker now. I create moments by interpreting words and sentiments and visually displaying them on the screen. But my little rant is because I'm frustrated because I can't remember the why, the what that caused the blackness to become this breathing, growing organism that when you walked into it, you felt like you're being suffocated. The irony is, as a child, I was that kid that liked to sneak out of his bed at night. Yes, when the house was quiet and dark. I was that character in that horror film that you're watching that is contemplating going down the hallway. He knows it's a bad idea. You know it's a bad idea. You want to shout out at the screen, don't do it. But they do. And I did. What's even more ironic, I braved the darkness to go down to go watch television and horror films that my parents didn't want me to watch. I'm talking about the old classics. I'm talking Lon Chaney as Werewolf, okay? Bela Lugosi as Dracula, Boris Karloff as Frankenstein. We're talking Vincent Price in those weird Edgar Allan Poe movies that he made. We're talking monsters like The Creature from the Black Lagoon. There were great stuff, but they scared me when I was alone in the dark. So, I decided to go talk to my parents. I went to my dad. I didn't tell him the whole story. I just said, enough. I told him I was scared of the dark. He didn't even ask why. He just said, all right, let's make this better. I really think I loved him even more right there. We came up with a plan, a ritual. I would walk into the dark room, take a deep breath, slide my hand on the wall. Now that's important because you have to understand the darkness and the blackness to me was like this large engulfing thing that would just swallow you up like some black jello. The wall was solid. It was stiff. It was real. So the answer was simple. Take a deep breath, slide on the wall, flick the switch, lights come on, monsters be gone. That worked for a while, till the monsters changed. Jaws. Wait a minute, it's a new monster and it's in daylight. I refused to go swimming for an entire summer, and I lived in California, a 20-minute bike ride from the beach. The other mystical monsters stopped. They didn't affect my psyche like those did, like The Omen or zombies or anything that wasn't real. What scared me more now were the Norman Bates, the Henry serial killers, the Johnny from The Shining, and eventually Hannibal Lecter. They were humans, not creatures. Humans whose minds had no scruples or empathy. Beasts who would devour up life in all its light. They were creatures that I could not comprehend, and worse, they could be an acquaintance, a neighbor, or someone in my life. Of all the monsters that scared me, though, the one I discovered about 7 years ago scared me the most. It was a black thing with dark eyes that were like an abyss that sucked you in. And that was its pleasure. It didn't want to eat you. It didn't want to kill you. It wanted to capture you, chain you into that abyss, and force you to look at the world through its black eyes. That discovery caused a lot of questions. Where did it come from? Why was it here? Was there a moment that I missed that was the catalyst of its birth? But the most horrifying moment was when I met it. I remember it like a still frame. I remember every still frame for the whole sequence. I was in Shreveport, Louisiana, working on a movie. I had been there for a couple of months. Some of the crew and I decided to go out to a bar to blow off some steam. But as the night went on, I felt like something was wrong. So I left, started to walk to the hotel. On the way to the hotel, I just wanted to hear my wife's voice, so I called her. But I got her voicemail, so I left a message. I said, just enough. I love you. I miss you. I hung up. I walked into the room and it smelled. It's that moisture smell because it's humid and I can't open the windows. And there's a low roar from the air conditioning unit. And it's just building like a sound design for the entire scene. The room is dark. It's empty. It's lonely. So I back up and wait, go back to what I did as a child. Take a breath. Slide my hand, feel the coolness of the plaster wall, the smoothness as I walk over to the switch and flick on the switch. And there is this thing with empty eyes and a heartless soul. There it stands. It's me. And my reflection in a bathroom. I'm not sure what happened next. It's a little vague. I think it's partially shock, partially self-survival. Told myself, hey, you're just a little drunk, a little depressed. It'll go away. It's just a thing. It's momentary. It'll pass, but it doesn't. After a couple years, events occurred in my life that were caused by me allowing this monster to put black poison into my life. It affected people around me, and people that I cared about had to run away for their own safety and their own survival. So this is where our story diverts. Normally in a horror film, the normal plot, you've got a moment of the hero arrives or the hero stands up. I was not that Ripley who killed the alien. I did not kill the monster so that it could not hurt anything else. Instead, I asked the monster to sit down, to share Jameson with me, not as a friend, maybe an acquaintance, but to come to an understanding that fear, doubt, and the lack of acceptance that I cannot control the world around me is what fed it. As time passed, the chains from that abyss loosened. I became less afraid of the dark, and even less afraid of the light. I heard less groans from the monster. The answer was simple. If I did not feed it, it could not grow. But I cannot deny its existence or the collateral damage that it created. More important, though, that every day that I walk in my life with some dignity and grace, the monster starves a little more.
Clearly, it takes guts to starve a monster or to respond at all. A lot of guts. Our final storyteller, Sam Schneider, this one's about Halloween. I'm not going to tell you anything more than that because that would nick away at the terrifying beauty of this story. I've said too much already. Sam Schneider.
Hello, everybody. So it's a little bit awkward because my story, it's about this time I went to Alaska and dressed up as a moose and scared the piss out of this white guy. I don't know. I feel like the thunder's been stolen out of... No, that is not my story. My story ends like any good Halloween story should. It ends with screams, with wailing, gnashing of teeth, and just a little bit of vomit, just a little bit. So that's where we're going with this. So let's back up. The beginning of my story goes all the way back to my childhood. When I was a kid, me and my family, my siblings, we lived in northern Minnesota. And we were the only Jewish family in the entire Northwest. Like we had invented Judaism. We were surrounded by Norwegians and Lutherans, and so we were already odd to start with. But we weren't really religious. I mean, we were religious because we were the only Jews, so we were religious like for comedic effect and for defiance, but not really. We did Passover, we did Hanukkah, but Christmas was really better, so we did Christmas. It was easier. But our real religion was Halloween. Halloween was our thing. And, you know, we could all get behind Halloween. There was candy. There was costumes. It was good stuff. And my dad was like the grand poobah, the minister of Halloween. Like, he was into this. And so every year we'd plan. And both of my parents were theater majors. And my dad did a lot of makeup. And so he had this like kid of makeup, right? And so he'd take his little kids that he really just had so that he could do this. Like that was the whole point of having the kids. And he'd sit them, we'd sit in a chair like Hollywood stars and there'd be lights on us and he would do our makeup. And this is like an hour event, right? He'd make these kids into little horrors, like the blood and like this is before zombies, so we were kind of ghouls, like the ghoulish zombie, but we're like this big, you know? And like my little sister was adorable, and she was when she was done. And we'd have blood and the fake plastic teeth for as long as we could keep them in our mouths, because you drool a lot with those. And he would do hair, like fake hair, patches of hair, mostly on me, because he'd use spirit gum. And if you've never used spirit gum, works really well for putting on hair, but also takes off quite a bit of skin when you're done. So you got to be really committed to the hair. But I was in, so lots of hair. And my older brother, too. And so not only were we the only Jewish family, but my older brother was adopted Vietnamese. So, yeah. So two white kids, white ghouls, brown ghoul, okay? Yeah. And so we'd all get done up and we'd put on burlap sacks and old costume or old clothes. We'd be all ratty. And he'd have these wigs that were just like, he got them out of some homeless man's shoe. I mean, they were disgusting wigs. And when we'd, these cute little kids. And then it's northern Minnesota, so it's like minus 50 degrees out, right? So we'd be all dressed up, and Mom would be like, come here, come here, come here, come here, come here. And she'd put 12 layers of down on us. So we'd be like, eh? These little Stay Puft marshmallow ghouls with, you know, little floating heads. Give us candy. And my dad would do the like sort of vampire overlord thing, and he'd walk with us and say, go children, get candy. So we did that for years. And then as we got older and we got more independent, we would go trick-or-treating by myself, which made my dad very sad because he didn't have his toys, his playthings anymore. So he started making his own sets. He'd make sets for people to come and get candy. And so he built like this dais with a throne on it, and he had lights, and he'd play also Sprach des Zarathustra and Phantom of the Opera in the background, and he'd have dry ice, tons of dry ice, making that fog going around, and he'd make his own mug of steaming blood. Yeah, and he'd drink it, and he'd be like, would you like some candy? And like, just, I can't even do it justice. I will never be as good as my dad. Some candy. And the kids would be like, little pee coming out. Yes, please, candy. And so it didn't take long for me to realize that he was having more fun than I was. So I started being my dad's sidekick. So, and this was great. Like, we would plan these elaborate pathways, and I would hide in places. And by then, this is before Gollum, but I had learned the Gollum voice by then. So I'd be like, "How would you love to come get some candy?" And you know, and it was great. And we'd have pumpkins on jack-o'-lanterns on pulleys going up and down. And one year I figured out how to hang myself. So I'm like hanging, and the kids would walk by, and I'd go boo, and they'd pee. There's a lot of pee at our house. They'd pee and get the candy. And my favorite, the best year, was we moved to upstate New York, and we kind of moved off the beaten track, so there weren't a lot of trick-or-treaters where we were, which made me and my dad very sad. We had one year where nobody came. So we took our Volkswagen van and went to Susan Riemensnyder's house and parked outside her house, because, like, who's not going to send their kid to the creepy hippie van for candy, right? Yeah. That's a good place. And so we did up the van, and Dad did his, you know, overlord dark character, and there was a curtain, and I was behind the curtain so he couldn't see me. And so Susan's mom would send them to us to get candy, and she'd be like, yeah, it's okay. He won't take you. He'll give you candy. And they'd come up, and he'd be like, hello, children. What would you like? And they'd be like, candy, please. And, oh, you'd like some candy. Claw, give them some candy. And I'd reach through, and my hand was all hairy and clawed, and I'd reach through with some candy, and they'd be, ah! And I'd drop the candy into their bags. It was so great. But all good things come to an end. I grew up, sort of, and went off to college, and my dad was left on his own, and my little sister grew up, and so my parents started having parties, which was a little weird for my parents. They're kind of introverted. They're not really partiers. We never had parties growing up, but they started having a Halloween party, and this was pretty epic. A lot of people came, and it came to be pretty well known, and there were two sort of key things to my parents' parties. The first was the costumes, and they really set the tone for this. Their first year, they went as lepers, and they made real body parts, you know, coming off. Throughout the night, you could see my mom's ear hair there and my dad's nose there. It was good stuff. And then the next year, they went as transgender ballerinas. So, yeah, this is 1980, way before transgender was cool. My dad shaved, and my mom grew a beard, and they put on tights and tutus, and they did a dance. It was amazing. And the best, though, was the hemorrhoids. They came as hemorrhoids, yeah. They made this costume out of balloons, like, they're just like a big, lumpy balloon, and they'd be like, what are you? I'm a hemorrhoid. Yeah, that's cool. And this is actually, this is how my bride-to-be met my parents. My bride-to-be, who's right here, she came to visit for the first time, and she'd heard about this, and she's like, oh, this is a lot to live up to. So she, and this is how I knew she was the one, right? This is how I knew. She came as a liposuction accident. Yeah, all her totally thought of this herself. She like got tights and stuffed it with foam and did something to her face. I think she got a bead of stinger lip or something, and it's just swollen here and lumpy here, but really skinny here. And then she did her face up all Barbie makeup-y, and she's like, ah, I'm so beautiful. It was awesome, awesome. So that was the costumes. The next thing, and this is really where we're going with this, was the centerpiece. So the centerpiece was where my dad really let himself, his creativity flow. He would think all year about the next centerpiece. And it started small, started with a cow's tongue. So if you've ever seen a cow's tongue, they're like this long and they're thick and they look like a tongue, right? It's a cow's tongue, it's incredibly long. And he carved a jack-o'-lantern, stuck the tongue in its mouth, and you put that on the center of the table. So you got this pumpkin with a tongue and all the food around it, right? Help yourself, happy Halloween. So that was year one. Year two, they collected all the mice that the cats brought for the whole year in the freezer. Yeah, yeah. My sister and I discovered that at Christmas. We came home and opened the freezer. Oh, that's different. Okay. And so they saved all those, and they made a little mice pentagram on the table, dead mouse pentagram, with the food. You know, there's food around it. Then the pig's head. They got a whole pig's head, just chopped off pig's head, and Dad baked it in the oven with a red glaze, so it looked like it was covered with blood. And then, because that's not enough, they stuck a naked Barbie in its mouth. Yeah. Makes you wonder about them, the naked Barbie, like, where did that come from? But, okay, so this all leads up to, there were a couple more, but this all sort of leads up to the last year, the last Halloween party. So about, you know, late spring, April, somewhere in there, my mom gets a uterine fibroid. So uterine fibroid is a benign uterine tumor. It's not a horribly evil cancer, but it's unpleasant, and she needed to get it out. Okay. Mom, not so much for boundaries. And lots of people knew that my mom was getting her uterus out. So she denies starting the rumor, but somebody started the rumor that this year the Halloween centerpiece was going to be the uterus. And this is, you know, like April. We're months away. Months away. And this rumor builds. And it's weird, because my parents didn't really run in the same circles. My mom was a lawyer. My dad was a teacher. But they overlapped. And by the time Halloween came, this was going to be the biggest attended Halloween ever. But it had that mixed, like, why are we going to this? There could be a uterus on the table. Like, who... Who wants to, this horror and attraction. And so, sure enough, they came to the party, and on the table is just a gold platter, big gold platter, with a lump and a cloth over it. Right, just a lump and a cloth. And the food, all around it. Don't forget the food. And that's it. And so, all night, people are just kind of orbiting around the table. Like, nobody looks. They're talking about it, but nobody looks. And it's weird. It's like this lump has its own shield or anti-gravity. Like, people look like they're going to get some food, and they're like, no, I don't need food. Like, yeah. So, you know, the party starts at 6:30, and nobody checks out the lump. And 7 o'clock, nobody checks out the lump. And 8 o'clock comes around, and nobody's checked out the lump. And the party's actually getting a little bit awkward. Like, this lump is really sort of taken over. It's hard to revel when you think there might be a uterus on the table. And so my dad, he goes over to the table, and it's all kind of hushed, and people are watching him, and he lifts lifts a little corner of the cloth, reaches under, pulls out a fingerful of something and sticks it in his mouth. And that's it. That was it. It was over. There was wailing. There was crying. There was some, so the vampire by the door ran out and there was audible vomiting in the, I mean, the myth that this was a uterus was so powerful. People left. It was done. The Halloween uterus party had come to a close. It was just a lump of peanut butter, right? Because that's crazy. Who would keep a uterus for 9 months or whatever? That's crazy. So, yeah, that was their last. It was their last Halloween party, and they moved. So it wasn't like they were like, well, this is too disgusting. We can never do it again. I think they moved and they realized, like, you know, like a pitcher would pitch the perfect game, or somebody who climbed Everest. They're like, this is as good as it gets. It is time to drop the mic and walk away.
Yes, indeed. The mic dropped and bounced several times there.
That was Sam Schneider reading his story earlier tonight, One Moss. In the previous two Pivot episodes that we carried, the opening one was Ann Porter and Cleve Penberthy, and then the Wednesday edition, Julie Humphreys and Raymond Reyes. The host for this particular Pivot, which took place on October 18th, was Tony Flynn. These stories are all put up as podcasts at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Go to the podcast section and look for Pivot, or within the schedule, go to the bookshelf and look for Pivot. One way or another, you should be able to find these to hear them again. For other information about Pivot Spokane, go to Pivot Spokane on your computer, and there you can find out about the many events that happen. They do about three of these main stage events a year and two or three Pivot Story Slams per year. And you can get involved with Pivot as a storyteller, as an audience member in many, many ways. Our thanks to all the storytellers of Pivot who are brave enough to tell their stories at all and certainly to allow them to be put onto the radio. Next week, we begin a new book, A Key to Treehouse Living by Elliot Reed.